This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, a podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. As a society, we seldom talk about death, but as I've learned, given an opportunity, people have a lot to say on the topic. For Series 2 of The Last Breath, I've asked all sorts of people to share their perspectives on death, dying and grief, assisted dying, faith and the afterlife. In this episode, guitarist Gary Verburn and Cambridge Museum volunteer Jill Morton share their perspectives. I'm talking with Gary Verburn. Gary, you're an IT specialist, aren't you?
Yeah, kind of, I guess. That's what I do, yeah.
And you're a musician as well.
Musician, yes. Played music seriously for many years. Love music. Big part of my life. Always has been.
You're still making music now?
Play a little bit. Bits and pieces with sort of some of the old crew. Not possibly as much as I'd like. But a little bit, yeah.
Do you keep up the practicing? I keep on hearing from serious musicians they've got to practice every single day. Do you still do that?
No, not really. I frantically practice if I've got gigs coming up. But I don't play every day. I play fairly regularly, but not in any constructive way, I guess. I don't have a studio or anything like that, like a lot of guys do. But still play, still listen a lot. Yeah, still a big part.
And you still get joy from playing?
Yeah, in the right contexts. Not like the old days. I don't like playing bars and things like that like we used to. But we don't do that many gigs. They're mainly festivals and things like that, and they're always pretty good. So, yeah. Yeah, I love it. The thing with playing music with other people is a great thing. You know, it's a form of communication. I've always found, anyway.
So, Gary, I'm going to ask you some interesting questions. Well, I think they're interesting. Are you afraid to die? Do you think about your own death?
Quite a bit, to be honest, yeah. I think it's good to think of your own death. It's the Buddhist mantra, isn't it? You know, one of the Buddhist teachings, we should contemplate our death several times a day, you know, to remind ourselves of that, you know, we're only here for a short time. Am I afraid to die? I'm probably more afraid now than I was maybe 20 years ago as it gets closer. But no, I see it as a part of life, really. It's just that last bit of life. It's got to end sometimes.
So how old are you at the moment?
I turned 64 this year. Yeah. So, you know, those things are starting. You start to feel a couple of things, right? And, you know, you lose people around you at this stage of life. They start dropping off. And, yeah, so it starts to come home. And, you know, when you're in your 60s, you're no stranger to death usually, right? You've had people, your parents, siblings maybe. You have the tragic deaths of maybe young people in your life. You know, you come across those things. It's there for all of us to deal with. In our way. I think it changes, though. If somebody told me I was going to die in 6 months, I might have a different answer for you, Andrew. You know.
Do you think you would accept it with equanimity, or would you?
Do you ever know? Can you ever really get that clear until it's put in? I think probably I'd make my peace with it, yeah. I have always tried to live a fairly contained life. It's not like I have a whole bunch of stuff that I'm, you know, want to do or anything like that, you know what I mean? Although I'm sure that, you know, it's a hard question to answer. I think I would. I would hope I would in some way. It's always the people around you, isn't it? You know, it's that's the people you would feel for, I think. Feel sorry for all the stuff that I haven't cleaned up in the shed, you know, that someone else will have to deal with. I probably better get onto that so they don't have to. but yeah, I don't know if you can really answer that question until it's actually staring you in the face.
Tell us about that Buddhist mantra. I've not heard that before.
Oh, yeah, it's to contemplate. I don't know what it's called, but in fact, I heard somebody talking about a smartphone app that they had developed, which was that encapsulated, basically. A little thing on your phone that 5 or 6 times a day would throw up a little maxim, some little saying to remind you that life is, you know, short, and maybe you should be concentrating on, not concentrating on that little thing and having a look at the big picture. You know what the name of the app was? We Croak, which I thought was beautiful, you know, because I think you need to be reminded that, that life is short, really, you know. And, yeah. Yeah, that's the Buddhist thing, is acceptance, isn't it? You know, we accept those things. Yeah. I mean, I've had deaths in my family that have been hard to understand and have been tragic. Young deaths, people taken suddenly, and it's not pleasant, man. But it happens, and it happens every day. Someone, you know, every day someone's losing. You know, there's a tragic death going on, and we've had deaths that have been, you know, old deaths that come as a relief almost. My mother's death was a relief. She had dementia, and, you know, the last couple of years of her life were unpleasant. Unpleasant for her, unpleasant, you know, it was awful.
That's interesting, because I hear this a lot. Relief, especially if somebody's died after a long illness. People say, God, I felt such relief, but then I felt really guilty for feeling that relief.
Yeah, we do. We're conflicted, because we don't know how to deal with grief, you know. We don't talk about it much. You're expected to feel a certain way, or you think you're expected, I think. Whereas grief is a personal thing, and it hits us at different times, and you've really just got to go on your own journey with grief, you know. And I think probably people hold a grief in, which is not a great thing either, you know. And the more we talk about it, I think it's probably a better thing to do, you know.
And that's an interesting point, and I'm glad that you said it, because we all do grieve differently. But there is an expectation that we all feel exactly the same way when we grieve.
But is there? I mean, because somehow we form that opinion. Nobody's ever really told us that. It's not written down anywhere. It's just something in us, isn't it? When someone dies, you feel sad, you know. When my father died. My father died, he had had cancer. He was quite young. He was in his mid-60s, only a couple of years older than I am now. He had bowel cancer. So he had a section of his bowel removed, 2 pretty good years, to be honest. And then he kind of went downhill in the last month. The last week of his life, he was in bed. I was living in Auckland, he was in Christchurch. And my sister-in-law was a nurse, and she'd come. She was with Mum, and I'd spoken to Dad a couple of weeks before this particular day, and then I get a phone call saying, "Oh, I think you better come home." And most of our family was, you know, my 2 brothers were down south of Christchurch, and we were all on our way home. I got home, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night, came back home. Mum and Dad were in bed. I was with my sisters at their house, and then my mum gets out of bed and says, "Oh, you better check on your dad. Something's happened." And my sister-in-law, who was a nurse, went in and came out and said, he's gone. And we all went into the bedroom. And the closest word I can put to the way that I felt was euphoric at that moment, right? And it was, I think, a feeling of love I had for my mother more than anything else. I'll never forget that moment. You know, and not that I really was, I wasn't expecting Dad to die that night. You know, I think you always downplay those things. In fact, I was, the weeks before, had I known that he was, I would have rung him more often, you know. I really wasn't aware at that stage what was going on. But I don't know whether there was a spirit in the room or, you know, we put our own words on things, don't we? On feelings we don't really understand. But that's the closest word I can find to that particular feeling at that moment, you know. He was dead, and my mother was, you know, she was grief-stricken, and I just felt this overwhelming sense of love for her that I'd never felt in my life before, and for my father, you know, but mainly for my, more for my mum, I think. So that, you know, later, you know, it took a long time really for the grief is one of those things that you sort of get used to, I think. I never forget at the funeral, I because you keep expecting to cry. One of your parents, you know what I mean? I never cried. And then we were, me and my brothers and my uncle were bringing the coffin to the church. I started, felt it starting to come. And I just clamped down on my cheek, you know, saying, I'm not doing this now, right? And then it was months later when he gave me his car. He had this little old Mitsubishi car that I drove back up to Auckland. And months later we were, you know, I used to start late in those days, and I'd gone to the gas station for some cigarettes, probably 1 o'clock in the morning. Came back to my car and realised somebody must have had hit the car while it was parked on the road, right? I just hadn't seen it before. And that was the thing that triggered me. I started crying in the middle of the of the petrol station forecourt. So grief hits you at different times, you know, and you can't force it really, I think. That was my experience anyway of my dad. When my mum died, it was different. She, you know, she had gone really for a good year. You'd get occasional glimmers of consciousness, you know, and it was grim. And she was in her she was 96 when she died. She was a strong woman, my mother. So it was really just her heart just wouldn't stop beating. You know, her brain probably collapsed in on itself, you know. That was tough to see, and I felt bad for her. I felt really bad for her. And you got no idea what's going on in her brain, really, you know. So it was kind of a relief, really, for that she didn't have to be like that, because, you know, who wants to be like that? She wouldn't have.
It came up in a conversation the other day. Somebody was saying that as our assisted dying policy in New Zealand evolves, should we include people with Alzheimer's and dementia?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's you're basically putting them down. That's a big decision to make. That would be a tough decision to make. I don't know where I stand. I'm all for assisted dying, but I certainly understand there are a lot of sticky points, and, you know, if you're writing a law, that's pretty hard to clarify, you know. I'm sure when it works well, fantastic. But I'm sure, would I have felt comfortable making a decision to put my mother in that space who couldn't talk for herself? That's a big call, Andrew. I don't know if I would have done that. I mean, people turn off life support. That's a different thing. Once again, until I'm in that position, situation, I don't know what I do. I mean, so we have assisted dying here, right? But not for those situations. Someone has to enact it themselves. And even the power of attorney over someone doesn't have the ability to do that, right? So, yeah.
Would you, if you've got a terminal diagnosis of cancer, would you think about assisted dying?
Yeah, I've thought about it quite a lot if I was in that position.
And what have you been thinking?
I would like to spare the people around me from the really grim latter stages of those diseases, you know. Having said that, I'd also like to live as long as I can. You know, I don't want to miss out on anything, especially once you, it's that decision of like, you're going to turn off the switch and not see that those handful of people that really are, you know, mean everything to you. That's the tough call, you know. So in theory, it's one thing, but if you could just hang on another day to see them, you know. But and that's the thing with dementia. Now, you know, having seen my mother go through it, I'm terrified that that's going to be my fate. But I mean, there's been lots of books and movies about, you know, well-intentioned people keeping a supply of drugs on hand for the, you know, that point in dementia where they, but then it's too late. You never get to make that decision, right? But do you want somebody else making that decision for you? Whew. because you can't speak for someone else. You don't know what their experience is, you know. And not all dementia is the same. I had an auntie who died of dementia, but she turned into this happy child, you know. It's just she didn't really remember, didn't know who anybody was, but she was, you know, just this bubbly little girl again. She wasn't curled up, you know what I mean. They're loaded, they're tough questions. They're tough questions, and it's not a one-size-fits-all, I think.
Do you have any perspectives on afterlife? When you die, are you just dead, or is there any more?
I'm not a religious person. I'd classify myself an atheist. Obviously, we're recycled, you know, ashes to ashes and all that. I don't think there's an afterlife in the classical sense of the way I was raised to think of heaven and hell. I'm sure there's something going on that's probably beyond our comprehension, but what that might be, whether it's anything, I'm not sure. I'm not banking on anything, Andrew. I expect to just die, to be honest.
Some people can't bear the thought that there's nothing after death, and to bring the subject up really, really upsets them. For some people, it means everything, that there's more. Does it worry you that there's nothing?
No, I've come to terms with that. I mean, my dog doesn't sit around worrying if there's anything, you know.
And they you're just living your life.
Pretty much, yeah. I don't see terribly much difference between us and the animals that we have around us. We're more highly evolved. I may be wrong. I mean, I do give room for more complicated answers than that. But I don't really. I mean, we don't really think about what happens to the birds that fall out of the sky and our cats when they die. And to be honest, I think that's us as well, you know. We're here and we might be remembered for a generation. Be lucky if we were remembered for two generations. After that, unless you've done something really bad, you know, you're kind of gone, so, you know. So 99% of the world's of humanity is forgotten, and way more than that, I'm sure. And that will be us one day. And I think that's the Buddhist thing as well. You've just got to, you're not that important in the scheme of things, really. You're a speck of sand. You know, not you particularly, specifically. We're all specks of sand, grains of sand.
Growing older, you're 64. Actually,
I was going to ask you the same question.
We're the same age.
Yeah, okay.
We're both 64.
It starts to kick. I feel it starting to bite, the thought of growing older now. I don't know about you.
I spend a lot of time with people in their 80s and 90s, and so I've become very aware of how it's going to go. So, like you, I think about death, but I also think, I feel great at the moment. I feel, in the prime of my life, I feel I wouldn't be young again for anything. This is perfect. But I'm also aware in 10 years' time, I'm not going to have the stamina I've got now. My skin's going to be sagging. I might have more health problems. And I know when I'm 80, it's going to be, I'm going to be probably half of what I am now physically. And thinking about that's been very healthy. I'm kind of accepting of it. If I get to be 85, I'd be very grateful. What about yourself, Gary?
Yeah, I intend to live a long life, you know, as long as I can, and hopefully as healthy as I can, you know. I mean, I try and walk and exercise quite a bit, and that's the prime focus, is just to keep myself in shape, really, you know. But yes, I'm well aware of that. What happens. And, you know, I'm not a big planner. You know, some people plan, they have big plans. They've got 10-year plans. I'm kind of, mate, I'm 10, lucky if I can know what I'm doing in 10 minutes, you know. So, and we, you know, we live on a big place here. That's not going to be tenable at some stage. So, but when do you do that? What do you do? So they're all interesting questions to be answered. Thankfully, I've got somebody, you know, my partner, Jane. We can make those decisions together. And So it's good. We look after each other, and that's nice. That's nice. I do. I'm thankful that I've got someone else in my life that, you know, that A, looks, has my interests in mind, and vice versa. Right, that's a good thing. I think that's yeah. I hope that I'm relieved of my worries as I get older, you know, or the anxieties of life, the financial pressures. I'm looking forward to the day when they can, when they recede a little bit, when I can just, live a day, live day by day, do effectively what I want, and not be too worried about things, you know.
Besides money, what things really worry you?
That's probably the biggest one, to be honest, long term. At the moment, I'm not really, occasionally I get concerned about world affairs. And that's, at the moment, probably more than I have been for a long time. I find the world in a precarious state. Maybe old people do that. I've heard that's a thing, you know.
Funny you say that. I had a very close friendship with a bloke who died in 2011, I think it was. He was 95. And I observed that in him over the years. I observed him becoming more worried. This is a man who survived 6 years in the Second World War, fighting in Asia, in some of the most horrific battles of the Second World War. I remember sitting with him watching the Gulf War on TV, and he's going, "The world has never been this bad. This is terrible." And I, at that moment, I thought, "Ah, it can get to us when we get older, and I've got to be aware of that."
Yeah, whether we engage with it more when we're older. I was oblivious to world politics when I was younger. I mean,
it was quite nice to be oblivious too.
Well, yeah, yeah, because you know, yes, but somewhere in the world, someone's getting, you know, hammered, right? That's the other side of that. And but you know, yeah, so that bothers me. I mean, you worry about the happiness of your children. It's always kind of a thing, and that, or maybe that never goes away, I'm not sure. But to see my, you know, and as they get older, of course, they become more self-reliant, and that's a good thing. That has caused me, I suppose, a lot of worry at certain times, you know. Not that you really, you kind of keep that hidden a little bit. But, you know, parents have concerns for their kids, you know. And that's all tied up with the state of everything, isn't it? You know, your kids' future. Our kids have a bleaker future than we had, Andrew, you know, which hasn't happened for a long time, many generations, right? So that's a little unsettling.
Are you happy?
Am I happy?
At 64?
I'm content, yeah. I'm content.
What's good about life?
I live in a beautiful place. Well, I have lovely surroundings, you know. I love where I am. I love the people that I'm with. I love my dog. It sounds funny, but that's a really important thing, you know. It's just those simple things. I've tried to simplify the way I feel about things, you know. You know, when I was younger, you sort of seemed to be driven to want a lot. Want this. And I chose, especially choosing a musical and artistic path for a while, you don't make much money. You've got to temper those. You have to really temper the wants and desires of life. You know, you're getting bombarded with ads and, you know, society is structured that way. So, you know, I sort of tried to shut that down. I'm pretty good at that, to be honest. I can live very simply. I don't look out too far. I'm quite content with the way that I am. You know what I mean? So, yeah. I'm contented most of the time. You know, it comes and goes a little bit, but that's just me, I think. There's always things that, you know, it's always things that you would do if you wanted to, I guess, if you could. I'd probably travel a bit more. I haven't done a lot of travelling. We're talking about travelling before. I haven't done a lot of travelling in the last few years. Mainly to see people. It's just seeing people that are overseas, family members, you know, extended family. Because, you know, you get your own family and you kind of, you just get entrenched. You dig in and all those people drift away, and that's sad. You know, I lost two sisters when they were in their 40s. So it's just maintaining connections to their family, their children, and now their grandchildren and things.
They died young.
They died young, yeah. They died. We had a 10-year patch when my dad died and then my two sisters died. Both of cancer, all of cancer, different cancers, all of them. But yeah, terrible 10 years for my mother and afterwards, you know.
So your mother outlived your sisters?
Outlived my sisters,
which
yes.
is always a parent's worst nightmare.
Yeah, no, that was not pleasant, you know, very unpleasant.
How did she cope with that?
How did she cope? She was in grief. She was living deep grief for many years, really. Interestingly, the last sister that died, Will, she was in hospital for about 3 or 4 months before she died. In the same ward was the daughter of a family friend of ours who had lost his wife some years before. Mum and him ended up getting together, which was a whole other story. It didn't end well, but for a couple of years, it lifted her out of that gloom, you know. So, yeah, which was an interesting story. I suppressed a lot of the grief about my sisters, I think. I think I still probably have. And I don't know, yeah. I mean, I moved, because I didn't live in the same city, I didn't see them as much as I, you know, you just, all that time, the relationships, especially in your older age, when I see brothers and sisters together, it's a lovely, it's a beautiful thing, you know. I still have a brother, I have one brother left that lives in Dunedin, and we see each other, you know, a couple of times a year, and that's okay. But yeah, I miss my sisters. And, you know, and they left kids, they left teenage kids, hard on those kids, man, losing your mum, really hard.
Just to go back to your dad, and you said, if I'd have known, I'd have rung him more. One of the things that haunts me, I think Dad's died two to three years ago now. I just didn't know what I was getting into when he's in a hospice bed. I didn't know about the process of dying. I didn't know the stages of dying. And I was in a lot of confusion about what was going on. I was learning.
Of course.
Learning through the experience. And I look back now and I think, God, I could have handled that so much better. If only I said this to him, why didn't I tell him what I felt? You know, why didn't I do this? It's too late now, of course, and you can't really beat yourself up about it, but it is nice to be aware of it. So if it happens again, I'll do it in a better way.
Yeah, yeah. It's experience though, isn't it? You know, and we're not used to talking, especially to our fathers. I'd say, you know, I should have rung him more, but I mean, when I spoke to my dad on the phone, all he'd talk about was what was wrong with his car and the weather. You know what I mean? He wasn't a talker, so actually talking probably wouldn't have done much anyway. You know, he was one of those, he was a man of that generation. They were quite closed off in some ways, you know.
Now that's interesting, because men of that generation were. My father was the same. Anytime I tried to broach an emotional subject with him, he would get quite vehement and shut it down straight away, just not going there. You know, don't try and hug me, for God's sake,
yeah, that's right.
You know. But I also have friends who have watched their fathers be like that and had made conscious decisions. When I have children, I'm going to be different. Did you?
Yeah, I was going to, that's just a thought going through my mind at the same time. I'm much more affectionate. My father was the same thing. I'd give him a hug and he'd be stiff-armed, you know. Whereas we're our generation is much different. You know, I was the youngest in my family, so I grew up with my nieces and nephews who I just adored. And we've been very affectionate with our children all the way through, you know, and I hug my kids all the time. My kids are adults now. But I still have trouble talking to, raising difficult subjects, emotional subjects with them. I still find that very hard. And I'm still a bit closed off with them for that, you know.
Could you speak to them like we're speaking now?
Probably I would find that difficult. Try and broach it. And it's there, because it's an interplay, isn't it? You know, you'll try and steer a conversation there, but if you're not, maybe their discomfort as well, that's contributing. But I find I still find it hard to really go to deep places
When did Claire die?
In 1986. How
old was she at that stage?
She was 21.
And before we get there, tell us about Claire and being her mum and watching her grow up.
She was born my mother's birthday, and she was very like my mother as well. She was outgoing, and she went to Australia when she wanted to go. First of all, she wanted to leave school, so at 16. So I said, well, she could if she got a job, which she did. And she was with a travel agent for about a year, perhaps 2 years, and then she went to Australia. And she got all up to all sorts of things there. She was an asthmatic as well. And she always said that she'd die of asthma before she was 30. She always told me that, but she didn't, of course.
Were you close?
I don't know. Looking back, I think I was a bit hard on my kids.
What do you mean by hard?
Well, I was brought up quite strictly, I think. And it sort of goes through the generations. I could have done better, I'm sure.
Well, first of all, what do you mean by strict?
I had a friend, and we used to meet, and she used to get down and play with her children. You know, really play with them. And I don't think I ever did that. Yeah, they were children, as far as I was concerned. I was the mother, and I don't know.
So you weren't their friend, you were their mother?
Until they got older, yeah. Yeah.
Were you an affectionate mother?
I don't know. I think so. Yes, I did everything I could. I wasn't very demonstrative, though, I don't think.
Well, if they were feeling upset, you would comfort them?
Oh, of course, yes. But Claire being the oldest and with asthma, and we had to give a lot of time to her. She was in hospital a couple of times with it as well. So, yeah.
So she's in Australia and she comes back at some stage.
She came back with asthma, actually.
Yeah.
And then she was in the hospital here and they were trying all sorts of different things on her. So she wanted to move down somewhere. She wanted to do something. She always wanted to do something. You know, she was an adventurous sort. And she went down to the South Island and she worked in the Hermitage in the South Island there. And she worked in Christchurch before that for a while. And then went to the Hermitage, as I say. And she had the accident between the Hermitage and Twizel along that long straight road. And where was she when? She worked somewhere else and she had to go to... Well, she went back to the Hermitage. And it took them all day to go around the host place and then up to the Hermitage as well. And it was there then that it happened. Anyway. Yeah, so the police came and told us at 3 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning, woke us all up. Oh, that was awful. Terrible. That was an awful time. It's the worst time of my life, I think. Yeah, you don't expect your children to die before you do, do you? Yeah.
So she died in a car accident?
Yeah, she was driving the car. And whether she was distracted or what, I don't know, but the car turned over and, you know, the road sort of is raised a bit along there. Yeah. But it was long and straight. We went back down there a few years later and they put a little memorial. There was one there, but it didn't say who it was. There was just a little cross there. And we went on to the Hermitage, but nobody remembered her. I think they had high turnover of staff there anyway. And we came back and just sat on the bank and just remembered her. Yeah.
In the aftermath of that, how did it affect you as a person?
I think it's affected me a lot, actually. I was quite friendly before then. Now... I don't make friends. Since then, I don't make friends. Except I've got one friend and she persisted. No, but other friends, I don't want to be hurt like that. It physically hurt. And I thought I was going mad about the April time. I really did. But it got right. And about 2 years later, it's much better.
So the pain was overwhelming?
Yeah, it hurt. It really hurt.
So you shut yourself down.
I think I did, yeah.
Pushed everybody away.
Yeah.
You didn't want
to. And I think I've been like that ever since.
You didn't want to experience that
level
of grief ever again.
Yeah. So you just take a sideways step and you just carry on, really. Yeah. And goodness knows what happened to the children. I don't remember. You know, the other two. I really don't. I don't remember Christmas. I don't remember the beginning of that year at all. I went to a grief counselling meeting and we'd all lost somebody. And I know one of the women there, she had two small children. Her husband had jumped off the harbour bridge. And it's just dreadful. And this person and this woman, she always ended these sessions. Oh, imagine you're in paradise, she says, and the sun's shining, the sea's... I ended in tears all the time. I was like, don't do that. But, yes, I think it helped. But, you know, you're not alone. A lot of children have died with parents who you discover later on. Yeah.
Do you still think about Claire?
Oh, yeah.
Every day?
I always say goodnight for her. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose she was a character, actually. She had one boyfriend who turned up. He was a born-again Christian, apparently, and he was dressed whole in leather. He was 6'6", I think he was, and he got gold chains all over him. And she was going out, you know. Anyway, it didn't last long. And another time she wasn't home at 2 o'clock in the morning. We rang hospitals and everything. She turned up at 4 o'clock. She'd been having a whale of a time. And for her 21st birthday, I went to Sydney. She was living in Sydney at that time. So I went there and we had a good week. Yeah, she went out most evenings and I went out during the day. And the other times we went somewhere together. There was another time. But we both enjoyed it.
She loved life.
Oh, yes. Yes, when she died, she was in the middle of arranging with a friend to travel around Europe on a scooter, Vespa, that sort of thing. Oh, yes. Anyway, it was a long time ago, 1986.
How long did it take you to find a degree of equilibrium again?
Oh, 2 years at least. And then I think I made a decision. You know, you step sideways and carry on. You can't go on like that. Yeah.
What about Alan?
Alan was different. No, he just immersed himself in work. But then I didn't have a job. But he did. He worked really, really hard. And he sort of, at one stage, he came out in boils and things like that. I mean, it's obviously stressful for him as well. Because she used to wait outside doors for him, Daddy, Daddy. And this sort of, she was a daddy's girl. Yes, it affected him a lot. But you have to go through this separately. You can't go through it as a couple when you lose a child. Because you each have your own way of dealing with it, with this grief. And I could see how it physically did it for him. And I know he was stressed and everything. And he worked for Faye Richwhite at that stage. And his job was terminated as well. Whether it was the following year or the year after, I can't remember. But that didn't help. No, we went through a really bad patch. And I can understand why parents divorce over a child's death. I really can. But we didn't.
They divorced because you said...
Because you're going through it so differently.
Did you talk about it together or...?
No, not really. Only generally. Yeah. It was really bad. And I put it behind me, you know. And then every now and again something happens. And it all comes rushing back as well. And it's not nice. And it lasts for a few weeks and then you're fine again, yeah. Yeah. They're never forgotten.
Even now, all these years later.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The grief still comes back.
Yeah. To a certain extent, not like it was. Not hurting or anything like that. And you can talk about it, because it was such a long time ago as well. But, yes, you never forget them. And there's always what if, and, you know, I could have been a grandmother again, and this sort of thing. You know, where would she have been living, and what would she be doing, and this sort of thing.
And you still think about that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Did Alan finally find his equilibrium again?
Well, I think so. I really don't know. I know he was in a bad way, but as I say, he just buried himself in work and did as much as he could.
And how did the kids get through that time?
I don't know. I've got a blank memory from the time she died till at least the April, when I thought I was going mad. I really don't know.
Could you describe that for me, this feeling of going mad? What was it like?
Well, you felt as though you couldn't do anything, really. You know, everything was wrong and the world was wrong. Why was everybody living when I was suffering so much and this sort of thing? I can't really, I don't know. It's one of these things that you put at the back of your mind.
When did Alan die?
Just over a year ago in December.
And how did he die?
The year before that, we'd been here 2 years. In November we got here. And in the December he went to the doctor and they said he'd got Parkinson's. All that year, he went in the January and they said, oh, it's just old age, you know. He wasn't shaking a lot, but he was shaking a bit and he was shuffling as well. And they confirmed it in December. And so we had from November when we moved here until the August when he fell, and he fell out there with the Parkinson's. He was diabetic too. And they took him to hospital. He was in hospital for a month and they found he'd got congestion of the lungs as well, which hadn't come until he had the shock of falling. And that's what eventually he died of. That's what they put on the death certificate anyway. But from the hospital that he went into care because he needed care, he was walking a bit with a walker and then he just couldn't walk by himself. So he knew what was happening. Looking back, I know he knew. He knew exactly what he was doing. Yeah.
He was accepting of what was happening?
Yeah, but he didn't tell me. He should have done. Because when he actually died, it was too soon, as far as I was concerned. I knew he wasn't going to come home again. But they rang me up and they said, could you come over? And we had a good conversation. And and then he said, oh, I haven't been to the toilet yet. And he got to the side of the bed. There were two nurses there and they were helping him up. And he fell backwards with the Parkinson's. And he didn't recover from that. He just slowly, you know, he didn't breathe anymore. And you couldn't help for anything better, really. I was there with him as well. They were so good to him over there. And they said, would you like... he went to Legacy. They had a... what do they call it? Something of honour, line of honour. And they put him on the trolley and they took him through. All the nurses were there and I thought it was lovely. Yeah, they were very kind to him. But he was 88. He'd have been 90 next month. and he lived longer. But you don't think of those things. I didn't anyway. I mean, you know, you're getting older. But I didn't think he'd die this quickly.
So he had a good death, and you were there with him.
Yes, he did.
And it must have been a stressful time leading up to that, you know, having to visit in the hospital.
Every day. Yeah. Every day to hospital and every day to the care home, twice a day to the care home. I'd go at 9 o'clock and stay to 9:30 to make sure he was all right. And then I'd go back at 2 o'clock for the rest of the afternoon. And it was good. I'd take him in a wheelchair and we'd sit in the courtyard there and they'd go to grass pit and we'd read until he wanted to come back. And then we'd read the newspaper. He had the newspaper delivered and then I'd take it home and have it afterwards. And sure he knew. Yeah, I loved him. I always told him that.
What are your memories of Alan? What are your...
Oh, it's lovely. He always calmed me down when I was stressed. And yeah. And he was a very good father. Very good father.
What makes a good father?
Well, he was always there. He'd take the girls to netball on a Saturday morning, rain and shine.
Did you feel the same sort of grief that you felt when Claire died?
No. Completely different. I feel it's... I know people got to die, and I'm glad he did it that way. I think it was a lovely way for him to do it. So that's what I think. I'm really sorry to lose him and all that. Of course I am after 64 years, but yeah. Unless I knew 6 cents, I don't know. I don't think it just felt I wasn't ready for it. I was just cross at him for leaving me alone.
Have you felt lonely since he's gone?
Oh, it's weird. I don't like it at all. I don't like living by myself. You come in the front door and it's empty. Even if there should be somebody here or some presence. Yeah. No, I don't like it. That's the way it is. And that's the way it will be until something happens to me.
Are you unhappy, Jill?
I'm not happy, shall we say. But I don't think I'm unhappy. I'm not happy or unhappy about thinking about death at all now. No. Just join him.
You scattered his ashes over the Christmas period, didn't you?
Yeah, and we had a lot of trouble with the council then. Because when Claire died, we had this tree at Snapper Rock Cemetery, which sounded a good idea. That went off really well, and we had the vicar at St. Peter's, because we belonged to that church, and he came and we did a little service. And that was lovely. But my kids don't go to church, so we wanted to do a family thing. And first of all, the Pahutukawa tree that we put for Claire, which flowered in December, all the roots had grown up because it was 40 years this year. The roots had grown up over the top of the plaque and it was at an angle. Oh, we can only have one plaque. Yeah, you can't have more than that. It's all rules and regulations and things. So I said, we cut the root out. So I said, well, suppose the tree dies. Oh, well. I said, no, I'm not having that. And, you know, and then they wouldn't answer me at all. I phoned them up and it was very stressful that time, I can tell you. And anyway, I said to her, can I scatter the ashes around the tree? Oh, no, you can't do that. We have a special scattering place. I said, no, I want it under the tree with Claire. So I said, if I come after dark and do it, you wouldn't know who put the ashes there, would you? And she said, silence. She said, no, I suppose I wouldn't. And that's what we were going to do. But the following week, we got an answer. And because I'd asked them all the right way to do it, they said, yes, and you can have the date you want, 6th of December. It's the day Claire died as well. And so there, someone dug a hole right next door. But we're still having trouble with the plaque. Because when we asked for it, they said, oh, I'm sorry, there's too much work to do. We can't do that. And then they can't have more than one concrete thing with a plaque on it. So so we're going to take the plaque off. We're going to have another one. We're going to turn it round slightly and put it in a slightly different place. If the council agreed, he's got to go before the council. And then we're going to have a book thing. So Claire's will be at the top. And then Alan's will be there and a blank page for me. The other two don't want to go there. They've got their own families. So if that works out, it would be lovely.
So you want to be scattered?
No, I want to be with them. No, we don't scatter them. They bury the box.
So you want to be buried with Alan and Claire?
Yeah.
Underneath the pahutukawa you planted for Claire?
Yeah, that's right. At that time, it was all countryside. Now it's a big housing estate.
Are you afraid of your own death, Jill?
No. No. It's how. How are you going to die? I think you're more worried about. Yeah. If it's something really nasty, it wouldn't be nice, would it? I mean, I think I've got a guardian angel. Is that silly? 5 years ago, I had chest problems, and I went to the doctor, and he says, we'll take you to hospital and have an examination, which they did. And a week later, they rang up and said, we found a mass on your lungs. You know, you definitely got a chest infection. So they gave me antibiotics, and it cleared up. But you've got this mass on your lungs. Anyway, a week later after that, they rang up and said, sorry, it's not on your lungs, it's on your pancreas. Well, we ought to do something about that. So we had an appointment at the doctor. Oh, he says, yes, you ought to go, but you don't know how long you've had it. This mass, they called it. So when I saw the specialist, he says, we ought to take a bit of your pancreas away because, you know, we don't quite know what it is. So I said, well, give it 3 months. If it grows any bigger, I don't know why I said this. Anyway, 2 months later, we went back, and he says, I think you ought to have it. So I had the operation, and they took a third of my pancreas away in the spleen. And now here I am. If I hadn't have had it, the report we got back, it was a lesion, a cancerous lesion. I wouldn't be here.
So you've got a guardian angel looking out for you?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure my sister's there.
Your sister?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. She's looked after me. When we came here, you know, I didn't particularly want to come to New Zealand. She looked after me.
Do you believe in heaven?
My mother was a spiritualist. Now, that makes a complication as well. I've had a very... Yeah, I went to a spiritualist school, and whenever she wanted to get in touch with anybody, she went to a service and she got in touch. Anyway, after Claire died, I thought, perhaps I ought to try this. So I went to Milford and they had a service there, and there were 14 people, and they got in touch with 12 of them. And guess what? I was the one that didn't get a message. So I haven't been to anything since then. But yes, I do believe in there is another... Yeah. My mother used to tell me about these angels that appeared at the top of the steps over her sister who died. She, you know, all the eldest daughters had died. Yeah.
So her elder sister died as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
Three generations?
Yeah.
What does that tell you?
It makes me worry for my brother. But I don't think it will affect him. I think it was eldest.
He has his daughter is the eldest.
Yes, but she's, no, I don't think it will affect her, no. No, I think it was three. It was quite weird though, isn't it? The eldest of three generations. Her mother was one of four sisters, but they were all right, I think. Yeah, they grew into adulthood, all of them. Yeah.
And so you'll see Claire and Eldon again?
Oh, yes. Not as they are. I don't believe in that. I think it's a soul. You know, when we buried his ashes, it wasn't him. Not really. And when I went on the bus, I was pleased that they cancelled my seat. But they said, oh, there's room upstairs. I said, oh, I'm 85. Do I have to go upstairs? And oh, yes. And he grabbed hold of my bag and took me upstairs. And there were two seats. So Alan sat on the seat and I sat here. And it was really good.
So you took him to Auckland on a double-decker bus?
Yes. Yes, I did. Yes.
So when you die, your souls will be reunited, the spiritual
absolutely.
Part of you.
Yes,
in heaven.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And this gives you comfort?
Oh, yes. Yeah. But I think everybody has faith in something. And it's a nice...
You said you're not afraid of death, but you're afraid of how death might happen, like especially if it was a long, drawn-out illness.
Yeah.
Would you do assisted dying if that was the case?
I believe in that. If it needs to be done, yes, I do. If there's no hope of recovery, if there's no hope at all, no, I think I'm all for it, the pill, yeah. I mean, some people go through terrible deaths, don't they? And you wouldn't do that to an animal, let alone a person. Mm.
So if you died suddenly, that'd be great.
My mother went to bed. And that was it. But she was 97.
But you're not going to like you're worried that you might suffer. So, but you also have thought
I'm
about.
I'm not worried about anything at the moment like that. But it's just, who knows what's around the corner? I mean, one day, I don't know. You've just got to have a fall or something.
You're nearing the end of your life.
Yes.
And
I'm 85.
You're 85. What's the worst part about growing old?
I don't think you're prepared for it. Well, I certainly wasn't prepared for old age. Yeah, I never gave it a thought, really. Yeah. And now I'm by myself.
Your health is good?
Yeah. Yeah, mostly it is, yeah. The odd thing comes up now and again, as it does with everybody. Yeah.
So for you, the hard bit now is just the fact that you're on your own.
Yeah.
And having to deal with that.
Hmm. Yeah, you go to talk about something. If you see something on there's nobody here. And I hate that. I really do.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.